Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Welcome and hello, and thanks again, Mom. That's Mom in the audience, one person. Can you believe the enthusiasm with that lady? She's amazing. She always thinks I was going to go far. she still has hope. After you're 60, you don't hear a lot of people say he's got a lot of potential. You don't hear that anymore. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. As a public service presentation, thanks, guys. They do this without a charge, and with free is the best price you can pay. And they do this because they believe in what we're doing. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. As the family goes, so does the country. We have found that most of the problems that we have today are about children who have grown up without parental supervision. They were not taught correct principles. This has a lot to do with it, the drugs and the alcohol epidemic that we're experiencing today. So what we found, Harold goes to the prisons, and in the prisons we find most of the folks in there also are drug and alcohol-related crimes. Some career criminals, but not as many as you would think. So this is really about getting that information once it occurs or before it occurs. What can we do to stem the tide? And this is what we're trying to do at Rum Radio. Harold, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks very much for that introduction. It's nice to be here. I consider it an honor and a privilege to be able to join the broadcast and help bring some information about what really makes recovery wheels turn. It did. It has for me and for you and millions of other people, and that's working with other people. It's nice to be here. I especially value being able to work with families and help recovery in that way. It's a family illness, and the solution is a family solution. Let me take a moment to tell our listeners about how they can call in and join us. If they dial the phone number, and once they get Blog Talk Radio, then press the number 1, they can ask a question live on the air. And the number is 949-534-0621. Again, that's 949-534-0621. I'd also like our listeners to know that this is not a money-making proposition. In fact, Joseph has invested his own money out of pocket to make the website go and the radio program, and I really appreciate it. There's a lot of valuable information. The website is called rumradio.org, and the radio program is Rum Radio. So thank you for doing that, Joseph, and I'm looking forward to getting to our tonight's guest. Sounds like it's going to be a wonderful program. Back to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Yes, it is. Tonight we have Dr. Alan Berger. He's a Gestalt experiential therapist. So this should be really interesting. Are you there, Alan?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Joseph and Harold. It's great to be joining you here.
Thank you.
Thank
you. If you just give me a minute, I'd like to get out with the start the show with a third step prayer. And then that leads me into the disclaimer that this is not AA. This is not NA. This is not CA. This is more like Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We don't represent, we have no affiliation with any of the other recovery groups. I like to use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text, because all 12-step programs derive from that understanding. So it's the template. And then the other 12-step programs evolve from this spiritual work. I believe this is a spiritual work. And how I figured that out was that there's a such thing as called a big book fairy. Do you know that? Do you know that, Harold? There's a big book fairy?
Yes.
They come in at night. The big book fairy comes in at night, and they put information that you've never seen before into the big book. You'll read something 100 times, and then all of a sudden, something's there that you never saw before. And you go like, well, where'd that come from? It's the big book fairy. As you grow spiritually, your understanding and your effectiveness will grow exponentially. So this is how we know it's a spiritual work, because as you grow spiritually, so does your understanding. So I like using the big book for that reason. And this is the third step prayer. It's found on page 63 of this basic text. And it states, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Amen, brother. Amen.
Thank you. You know, before I start, I'm trying to get, if you notice, I'm trying to go a little faster. I had written something this week for Christmas. And it came to me, this is interesting, Christmas morning. And I was alone. My family's not available to me. But I'm okay. You know, I really am. I'm grateful to be where I'm at. Wherever that might be, I'm grateful for that. And I started writing. I was going to write something humorous about the night before Christmas. I had written that, and I couldn't find it. So I said, you know, I think I'm going to sit down and write the 12 steps of Christmas. And I sat down and I literally was able to write the whole thing in one sitting in about a half an hour. Now, of course, it's changed, and I have the quirk, a little eccentricity. You know, the rich are always considered eccentric, referred to as eccentric, but the poor can't afford eccentric. We have to settle for just plain crazy. So So what I did was I sat down and then I send out the basic draft, you know, and then as time goes on, I clean it up and polish it and clean and polish it, and it changes over a bit of time, and that's just how I do it. Okay, and this is it. I wanted to pass this on. It's a quick read, so you'll enjoy it. I enjoy it, so you'll enjoy it, I'm sure. The 12 Steps of Christmas. On the first step of Christmas, my true love gave to me the gift of desperation and a life of unmanageability. On the second step of Christmas, my true love gave to me a belief that there was something much bigger than me and the hope of being set free. On the third step of Christmas, my true love gave to me that the bigger than me could set me free if I could and would agree wholeheartedly. On the fourth step of Christmas, my true love gave to me courage and a writing pen, and spoke about notes and the loss of friends, family, and morality. And this would give me new eyes to see what was my part in the stock-taking bottom-line accountability. On the fifth step of Christmas, my true love gave to me a chance to speak of my worst and my best and get it off my chest with another caring being who could introduce me to God for the very first time. On the sixth step of Christmas, my true love gave to me the strength to let go of all things that were spiritually blocking me. On the seventh step of Christmas, my true love gave to me a sense of time that was no longer mine and said to overcome, I have to let go and learn about trust. And if I was to grow, this was a must. On the eighth step of Christmas, my true love gave to me a list of all those who had felt my sting and be willing to patch the scratch, fill the gouge, and cross the fiery bridge with humility and an olive branch. On the ninth step of Christmas, my true love gave to me 7-league boots to travel to the ends of all creation and a hat to hold when asking for the forgiveness of gold and to make whole what once was broken, to give back what was stolen, recant the vicious lie, whatever the cause, and do not further damage to another man's heart. On the tenth step of Christmas, my true love gave to me the mirror of accountability. The task was to examine all my actions, for it was a journey with distractions, and when off course, set it right immediately. Know how big the fight, and God would see to the rest, and if after all it was for my very best, if done each and every night. On the 11th step of Christmas, my true love gave to me a conversation with the Almighty to speak the words of gratitude for the rescue from a hopeless state and listen for thoughtful instructions for course corrections to my spiritual compass and examine every mistake. On the 12th step of Christmas, my true love gave to me the spirit of the universe now alive and growing in me with the agreement that I stay on the narrow way. I would find my greatest joy in work or at play, for when I'm in the service of my fellow beings, I am but in the service of my God. When sharing the living gift of recovery, we will fill the measure of our creation and find joy therein. For love and tolerance is our code, and service to our fellow beings we have found to be the lightest load. And I end with this. Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business. Marley's Ghost, Charles Dickens. Merry Christmas, Mr. Scrooge, if keeping with the situation. And we end at see you on the radio, rumradio.org. There you go.
I like it. I like it a lot.
Well, thank you. It's got a buzz going on Facebook, that's for sure. It was kind of inspired. I have no doubt about it. It's really way over my pay grade, so I have no problem telling you that. I read it and go, like, who wrote that? Other people say the same thing. Joseph, by the way, who wrote that? You know, look, I'm telling you, I had the pen, but the rest of it wasn't me. Trust me on that. Basically, it was the birthday boy gave it up. So, okay, well, let's get started. I can't wait to hear your story, Alan. So tell us, what was it like, what happened, and what is it like now?
Well, my journey started in 1971. So this past summer, I celebrated 42 years clean and sober. And I came into the program at 19 years old. And
wow.
Congratulations. I was very young, you know, and at that time there weren't an awful lot of people in recovery. So I feel very, very fortunate, and I'll tell you that when I ended up, I should say it this way, that when AA found me, because I didn't find it, and there just happened to be a group of young people that were clean and sober as a result of this woman in Hawaii called Slobert. But you'll hear that story when I get to it. I started drinking very early. I was, I'd say, 12 years old. And
wow.
My first drink was about 6 months after I lost my father to cancer. And that was a total devastation. I mean, this man meant the world to me. I was very close to him. He loved being a father. I was the oldest of four children. And every moment that he could, he was spending time with his children. I grew up in Chicago. We'd go to the museums, the Lincoln Park Zoo, Foster Avenue Beach. It was an amazing life with him. Every day I'd get up, I'd look forward to living. You know, he was that hands-on kind of dad that you just, that was just a kick. You know, in the wintertime, he'd get a Triumph motorcycle, he'd hook a ski rope on the back, put some snow tires on, and we'd go, he'd put us on those little flying saucers, and he'd drive us around the neighborhood on the snow. I mean, it was a gas. I mean, there was always kids at my house. He would be playing with all the kids. So when he died, there was a big, big vacuum in my family. And I said, tell everybody that his presence was so powerful that my mom just couldn't recover right away. She just got lost in her grief. And my grandfather, his father, this was his only child. He was completely devastated. So as a kid, as an 11-year-old, he died in 1963, I not only lost my dad, but I lost my grandfather and my mother as well, because they were succumbed by their grief. And I look back, and what happened is I just shut down. I just froze inside. I described hearing about his death the day after Christmas in 1963, December 26th. I was looking out the window on Argyle and Laverne Street in the northwest side of Chicago, and I was looking at the snow, and inside me I felt like I froze just like that snow. So that was the beginning of really my issues, I think, is that because I shut down so much, I didn't want to be alive. I had kind of resigned, given up on life. I was just kind of going through the motions after that. That spark, that desire, that passion for living was gone. And about 6 months after that, I got exposed to my first drink. A guy at the neighborhood at Robert Square Park, that's where all the cool guys hung out, he offered me a beer and I drank it. And at that moment, I came to life again. And I tell everybody, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but the minute I took that drink, an alcoholic was born. And that was the beginning of my journey into alcoholism. I mean, it felt great. I felt great. I felt connected to myself again. And if one was going to be good, more was going to be better. And pretty soon, at the age of 12, I started having blackouts. That continued for the next 7 years of my life. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could. I ended up being really essentially kicked out of high school at 16 years old. At 17 years old, I volunteered to go in the Marine Corps. And at 18 years old, I volunteered to go to Vietnam. And in Vietnam, I started using drugs other than alcohol. And the problem just got much, much worse for me. Came back from Vietnam in 1971, and I was a full-blown addict alcoholic.
Let me ask you this. I was in Vietnam. Where were you?
I was outside of Da Nang. I was on Hill 55.
Oh, okay. I was up in Chu Lai and I Corps, so we were in the same Corps. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And what year was that?
Yeah. I was 70 to 71 over there.
Oh, I would already be there. I was 67, 68.
You were there a few years earlier than me.
Yeah, I was there for the first cat.
Yep, you sure were.
Yeah, January.
Yeah, where I was there, things had calmed down quite substantially from when you were in country, but, you know, it was still you're in a combat zone, and you're still in combat and experiencing all of that craziness that goes with it. So I came back to the States, and, you know, the condition that, you know, the kind of the spirit of the times, I mean, they were very much against the war. I was very much ashamed that I had participated in Vietnam, and I really didn't talk about it to anybody. And I think that fueled some of my using as well when I came back. But, you know, my problem just got a lot worse. I started experimenting with a lot of other drugs. And so I had 1 year left in the Marine Corps. I went back to Chicago for a 30-day leave. And then I was flying back for my last duty station. And in L.A., I got busted with a bunch of drugs, getting on the plane from Chicago to Hawaii, or for, I should say from L.A. to Hawaii. And the two LAPD airport officers took me in the back room, and because I was a Vietnam vet, they were willing to not put me in jail at that point, but they were going to report me to my commanding officer. And, Joseph, you know what that means. I mean, big time. Because there was a zero
tolerance.
Yeah, Article
15.
You know,
yeah, oh,
that's
sure.
That's right, Article 15 I was going to be. So I, you know, like I always did, is I was trying to figure out how I could get out of the trouble I just caused. I decided to turn myself in and say I needed help. And I really didn't want any help, at least consciously. I just wanted to get out of the Corps so I could keep punishing,
yeah,
you know. That's what I was looking for. So I get to Hawaii. I go ahead and hatch my plan to turn myself in so I can avoid the Article 15. And unbeknownst to me, 3 days before I did that, the Marine Corps had started what was called the Drug Exemption Program. And instead of prosecuting Marines under Dakota Military Justice, they decided to put us in treatment. So I was the third Marine admitted to this program on the third day of the program.
Wow,
and,
that was godsend.
Oh, I'll tell you, man, that was a serendipity. I mean, it really was. I mean, I did, you know, like I said, my plan was to get thrown out of the Marine Corps, and here I am put in rehabilitation. Now, the staff there was new. It's a brand-new program. They really didn't know what they were doing, but they knew they didn't know. So what they did is they turned to the 12-step community for help.
Hmm.
And there happened to be a group of young people that had found the 12-step way of life through a woman by the name of Flobert. And this was one of the, you know, saints in AA, in my opinion. This woman dedicated her whole life to service. She had no worldly possessions other than a bag and the clothes that she had in it. She'd get up every day and pray to God for direction, and God would send her somewhere to find some one of us that was in sick and in need of help. And she collected a group of about 20 or so young people that lived with her and learned this way of life. She had left the island when I was there, but many of the people that had found the program, you know, through her guidance, were there and actively working a program. And two of them, Tom McCall, Kat, and they don't mind me breaking your anonymity, they came to the Marine Corps base and they shared their stories with us. That was on Tuesday nights. It was the Tuesday night drug rap session. Eventually, that became the first NA meeting on the island of Oahu. But at that point, it was just a rap session. They'd come in, they'd talk about their experience, strength, and hope. And the night I met Tom McCall was magical because he awakened something in me, Joseph and Harold, that I think you guys will recognize, is he awakened the possibility that I could be free from the bondage of the self, as you read in that third step prayer. You see, I didn't know how to deal with any of the feelings I had. I didn't know how to deal with my pain, my grief. I didn't know how to deal with my insecurity, my fears, my anxiety. I didn't know how to deal with my when things didn't go my way, my frustration. And here was a man that was talking about how he felt about these things and sharing things, first of all, that I would never share with anybody, and doing so with the complete acceptance of himself, and also talking about ways of managing these feelings without using. See, the only time I felt that degree of personal freedom is when I was drunk or high. And here was somebody experiencing that degree of freedom without using anything. And that really woke up something inside of me. It woke up that there was a possibility that I had never dreamed of. And that's the thing that hooked me to the program. When I experienced that with Tom and felt that way, I went up to him and said, you know, how can I make this happen in my life? And he said, stay close, and I did. And we worked the steps, we went to meetings together, and I became a part of the fellowship, and it literally saved my life. Now, that was in the summer of 1971. Tom, I'm pleased to say, is still my sponsor today after over 42 years. I went to the island that he lives on. He lives on Kauai now. And I celebrated my 40th birthday with him a couple of years ago. And he passed on his 40th chip to me, man. And it was an amazing experience. And I brought my whole family over there for them to be a part of that celebration. So it's been an unbelievable journey, but it started with that awakening, with the realization that it was possible to discover some new possibilities in life, possibilities that I had never even imagined were possibilities. And that, like I said, that really tweaked me because, and I believe for me that that's the thing that had to happen or is the most powerful way of really getting into the program and staying is that when that growth force inside of us gets awakened, that it's the most powerful motivation and it keeps us around. See, I would get motivated when I was afraid of things, but that motivation was so short-lived. And as soon as things got better, I gave up, right? I quit doing what I was going to do to change. So that kind of motivation, that motivation out of pain, out of trying to fix something that's broken, you know, it's not as powerful and as stable as what Tom awakened inside of me. And that was the possibility of a new way of life and that I could grow according to some spiritual principles in my life and develop the best possible attitude I could take towards myself, towards others, and towards life. So that's when the journey started, gentlemen, back in 71.
That's amazing. But, so you would say that the turnover was step five for you when you did your fifth step?
Well, it really was before that. It was really hearing Tom talk about his life so personally. Now, when I got to, and that was about 3 to 4 months into my recovery, we worked the steps, that was a whole other level of freedom. Because now I was talking about things with someone that I had never dared to talk about my whole life. Shared things with someone that I thought I was going to take to my grave as a secret. And that created another whole level of emotional freedom that I started to experience as a possibility when I first met Tom and now started to become more of a reality when I worked steps 4 and 5. Very, very powerful experience.
Now, did you find Tom, did you say, or did he find you? It's just kind of...
He came to that Tuesday night wrap meeting and shared his story. And so Tom found me. He came there, but I went up to him. It took my willingness, my interest. And that's the other thing I tell people a lot, is that once that interest in that new way of life was tweaked inside of me, that really provided a very strong motivation. And that's what he did, man. He really did awaken that interest in me that things could be different.
You
so
know,
I
have on the...
Go ahead.
On the website, I wrote a post on the iconic description, the man on the bed. You know what I'm talking about, right? It's
Oh, yeah, sure do, right.
Right. Okay, it's a 1955 description of Bill W., Dr. Bob, and Bill D., number three. And it depicts what happened in 1935. Now, if you ever take a close look at this iconic description, the fella has a book in his hand, which was 4 years prior to the publication of the Big Book. Dr. Bob was 18 days sober.
Wow.
He realized he was the motivating force because he bought into what Bill was telling him, that the only way they were going to keep this thing is that we're going to have to give it away. So being a doctor, where would you find drunks in the detox? You know, you find them at the hospital. So they went on, I believe, to Akron Hospital, and they found Bill D. And so when they're talking, it wasn't about the Big Book, probably the Bible more than likely. That was usually the only book they let you bring in anyway. But it was the power of one drunk talking to another that really created AA, because it says when two or three come together with no other affiliation, they can call themselves an AA group. So that's basically a picture of the first AA group. And if you'd like to cast the characters, you had a doctor. Bill W. was the chief architect of AA, and Bill D. was a lawyer. So we had a doctor, a lawyer, and an Indian chief.
Yeah.
I thought you'd like that cat out. Yeah. So it's the talking. That's the key. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's what it was. I mean, listen, it was Tom sharing his story with me and being willing to be just completely transparent without trying to convince me of anything.
Right.
I think if he was trying to sell me the program, it would have turned me off. And
right.
he truly lived by that principle of attraction rather than promotion. I got turned off whenever anybody tried to sell me anything. If they were selling me religion or a car, or it didn't matter what it was, if there was a sales job going on, it just really made me feel very distrustful. And what I realized, Tom didn't do that. And that I understand from reading about the history of AA, that's when things started to turn around for Bill W. when he was going out and doing 12-step work, is when he quit trying to talk people into this way of life and instead shared his way of life, that people were able to now, you know, find a way, you know, that he woke something up in them, just like was awakened in me, that reached out to him and said, help me find this. So I think it's a very powerful principle that we've discovered in the program and why the program has grown, I mean, unbelievably so over the years since its inception. So that was my journey began back then in 71. I stayed very close to Tom over that next year. Now, another very important thing happened. The program didn't have any counselors, so to speak, so after I had about 60 days clean and sober, I was invited to join the staff to be one of their drug counselors and to help some of the Marines that were coming back. And that's the second thing that happened for me. I really discovered that I loved working with people. I loved what we were trying to do, and that was the next pillar in my recovery, the next leg to the three-legged stool that I was starting to build, was realizing that, you know, that being of service and trying to help other people find this way is what I wanted to devote myself to. And we knew nothing. I mean, I had no education. I was a high school dropout. But what we had was a sincere desire to help. And we just loved and cared for those folks that walked in the door until they could start caring for themselves. And it was amazing. It was just phenomenal, the number of people we helped those days with very little knowledge of what we were doing, other than, like I said, having our hearts in the right place. So the third thing that awakened in me that first year was I decided after we were trained by several psychologists that I wanted to go back to school and become a psychologist. And that was a pretty daunting goal when I'm looking at being a high school dropout that has a GED, right? So
yeah.
I took my first class in Hawaii. It was oceanography, and that's the third miracle that happened for me in that first year is I realized that I love to learn. I mean, I hated school when I was going to school because I just wanted to drink. It was interfering with my time drinking. But now, when I was going to school for the right reason, because I wanted to, now I fell in love with education. And that started a long journey. The next 16 years, I would go to school. I got my Bachelor's of Arts in 1977, so that was 6 years after I started. I got my Master's in 79, and I got my PhD in 1987.
Wow, what a journey.
What a journey. You know, and all the time, the foundation for all of that was the 12-step program that I was living and working and attending, and it really was my foundation for my life. And I needed that because there was a lot of times when, you know, I didn't have much support. I was getting a GI Bill. And I tell people sometimes that when I was a treasurer at the this meeting on South Street in Long Beach, I would borrow a couple bucks from the kitty every week until I got to my payday so I could buy some yogurt and stuff and eat for a couple days. I mean, that's what things were like. But, you know, it didn't matter. Didn't matter that I was living in a studio because I loved what I was doing. I loved every minute of it. I loved going to school. I loved going to meetings. And I just loved the life that I had discovered. And so that was the journey that started. And it all got kicked off from that first year in recovery. And I really thank Tom and all the fellowship in Hawaii that helped give me such a strong foundation in the steps. Because that's what I found my most strength in, is working those principles and trying to integrate them into my life. And always having to remind myself, you know, this is not an event, it's a process. And that we're striving for progress, not perfection. But boy, that perfectionistic side of me, you know, always wants to take hold and figure out how to do this stuff perfectly. And which, you know, my God always reminds me doesn't work, right? I always get a lesson of humility at some point in time when I'm going down that journey. So that's what it was like. I went back to school. You know, now I can give you a kind of a quick glimpse of what things are like now. I've been blessed in just so many ways. I've got three blissful children. I've got a daughter that teaches ninth grade in the inner city here in Los Angeles, who's a remarkable young lady. She's going to be getting married next year, or in 2015, I should say. I got a son that just received his master's degree, and he's an exercise and nutritionist, exercise physiologist and nutritionist. And he's just really amazing. He's working with a lot of student athletes at a place out here called Velocity. And I'm blessed that I have a daughter in my life that's now 9 months old. And her name is Madeline Rose. And she is just such a blessing. I mean, that I get a chance at this late age in my life, I'm 61 years old now, to be a father again and to you know, be able to share my life with her and to watch her grow and just see the miracle of life unfold before my eyes. So on a personal level, that's where things are at. My wife, Jessica, is amazing. She's a cancer biology researcher over here at UCLA. And professionally, you know, I've written several books for Hazleton now. And the first book I wrote for them, 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery, I can say it's just been so well received in the community. I think there's over 50,000 of those books sold already, and it's still going strong. And
what was the name of it?
Was 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery. And it's a lot of fun, and people are, you know, it's got over 48 reviews on Amazon from people in the program, and they're just saying that they've got so much help out of it. So I can't tell you how, you know, that warms my heart that I can share my experience both personally and professionally in that kind of a medium and reach people that, you know, I would never have a chance to reach in my life.
Can you give us a thumbnail on that?
I'll just give you a couple of the 12 stupid things. I mean, these are things that you guys would recognize that you've heard. I mean, one of the things is that thinking my only problem is drinking. And I can go ahead and smoke marijuana every now and again or, you know, take some Vicodin or something like that. And what we know is that this is a brain disease now, you know. That once we cross that line and we become an addict, that switch got thrown in our brains. And, you know, for a while you may be able to control it, but eventually it's going to lead to the same problem it's led to you before. So that's one of the things I say is that, you know, if you believe that, you know, your problem is only with drinking and you can use other drugs, you're setting yourself up big time. And vice versa. You know, if you've used drugs and you think, well, I can go ahead and drink, you know, it's going to result in the same thing. And that's what so many people, I think, in NA have found. Another 12 stupid thing was, you know, putting less energy into your recovery than you put into going out and getting high and getting loaded and drinking. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd go to any length if I wanted to go ahead and party. And did I put that same level of commitment and enthusiasm into my program? And I think I did, and I think that's partly why I'm here today. But a lot of people don't. They take half measures, and what do we say? Half measures avail us nothing, right? It's not going to work. So those are the things I'm talking about. Another thing is thinking that you don't have to go out and make those amends. You know, doing steps 4 and 5, learning about yourselves, and then plugging that information in and working steps 8 and 9. Those are the paths to this emotional sobriety thing that I think is so important for us. So, you know, the books helps a lot of people, you know.
kind of step back and see, God, if I don't address this stuff, I'm setting myself up for a relapse. So I'm really excited with that. The book after that was a book that was based on Bill's letter that he wrote in 1956. My second book is all about emotional sobriety. And if you guys read that letter, The Next Frontier, that was a Grapevine article. I mean, if
no,
you guys
I hadn't.
Haven't. Oh, I'll tell
yes.
you.
Joseph, you've heard it. I read it as the I read it to our group at the Lamplighters on occasion.
Isn't it amazing?
Well, maybe you weren't there. Anyway, go ahead.
No, but it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, Harold, I mean, it's such – I mean, Bill, this was written 21 years, you know, after – on Bill's journey. He wrote it in 1956. So his sobriety started in 35, so 21 years later. And this in this letter, he's sharing all of his insights into understanding what created his depression. And he realized that the bottom line of this, his basic flaw had been that he was so emotionally dependent on other people for his self-esteem. And that he had to break that dependence if he was going to ultimately get this emotional freedom that he was looking for. And I'll tell you, when I've looked at that in my own life, boy, Bill just really put his finger on a very, very core issue that I think we all struggle with. And, you know, as a psychologist, I went to school and I studied. I do retreats on this emotional sobriety. In fact, one's coming up next year at Hazleton. It's at the Anderson Renewal Center in April. And where I take people through a lot of the other psychologists who were writing about very similar issues during the time. And you realize how all of these people were talking about the same thing, but just from their unique perspective. And so Bill really had an ability to capture the essence of our struggle, didn't he? I just love Bill's writings. I mean, because I think he was so insightful on this stuff, and he was really blessed.
I agree.
And really, I call this his fourth legacy. You know, the steps being legacy number one that Dylan left us, the tradition being legacy number two that they left us, the general service office being legacy number three. But emotional sobriety is really Bill's fourth legacy as far as I'm concerned. So it's really powerful stuff. And then this last year I was able to write a book about steps 8 and 9 and 10 and the hidden rewards of making amends. And I'll tell you, that's the heart and soul of this path to emotional sobriety, is to really, really go ahead and facing ourselves and then facing the people that we've hurt and cleaning that up and then really developing a practice of self-examination on a daily basis. I mean, I think that that step 10 has been so important in the quality of my life and in the stability of my recovery today, which, you know, I still consider myself having to manage my vulnerability to addiction on a daily basis, even after 42 years. So,
yes.
You know, each day to me is a day that's filled with grace and to have freedom from this incredibly destructive illness that we experience.
So one of the diseases
so
we don't really speak
about. Let's go ahead.
I said one of the problems with recovery people don't get in, I call it restless laurelitis.
Uh-huh.
Resting on your laurels. You know, you get
yeah,
to a certain level. Yeah, the big book says our sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of a daily spiritual condition.
So
I ask the question, what maintains itself? Even the sun will extinguish in its day. Nothing really maintains itself of itself. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually.
Yeah.
And if you're declining spiritually, what you're threatening is your recovery and then eventually your sobriety.
Yeah, that's right. No, I agree with that too. And that's why I really think that as people stay around, this whole issue of emotional sobriety, if they're going to continue to grow spiritually, has to be addressed. Fred Holmquist from Hazleton, he calls it sober suffering. I love that term, sober suffering. There's so many of us that are clean and sober and that are suffering right now out there. And it's not necessarily unnecessary, because I think suffering is very necessary in life, but it's unnecessary to keep suffering without getting the help you need.
And like you said, if you rest on your laurels and don't reach out, and that's another stupid thing I put in my book. You know, a lot of people don't turn and get the professional help that they need at times, Joseph. I mean, they get stuck into, and I understand this. Listen, I think a lot of professionals have made terrible mistakes with alcoholics and addicts, you know, and sending them to psychiatrists and getting them put on Valium and all that stuff. But there's a growing number of us that are not only 12-step friendly, but are 12-step based in our work and really have integrated the 12 steps into the kind of work that we're doing. And I think that for me, when I look back in my recovery, the times that I've gotten professional help just, I think, were incredibly important. Remember I talked about my grief with my dad? Well,
yeah.
That had to be dealt with at some point. I mean, I went to a weekend marathon, and the group leader, after he heard my story, put a pillow out in front of me and said, okay, say goodbye to your father. And, you know, you can imagine what came up over the next several hours as I was talking to that pillow. I mean,
oh,
all of this stuff, man, that I suppressed, that I didn't want to deal with. I mean, I was crying. At times I was screaming. I was beating the pillow. I was hugging the pillow. I mean, it was so freeing to be able to deal with that. That would have never happened just in a meeting. You know, I needed that level of experience, that kind of therapeutic experience to help open up some of these parts of me that were just so closed and that I was so cut off from.
I wrote this. You might like this. It's about depression. I call it the original 4G network. Losing contact with God. Losing
yes.
interest in goals. The goblin of self-pity. And the inactivity of a stone. What I've had to learn because of my personality, some people don't know me and they don't like me. Some people get to know me, then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me, because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time. I'm sorry to tell you, not many people are thinking about me unless I give them a resentment. And if you can give them a resentment and you're there in there in an alcoholic's head long enough, you can build a room addition. So
but,
now
you know,
the,
the other part of this is, Joseph, for you is obviously through Rum Radio. I think you are touching the lives of a lot of people, and, you know, that you are touching them in another way. And that's what I tell everybody, because, you know, it's this whole idea that as we grow in this emotional sobriety, is what we do is we learn how to stay connected to another person without losing ourselves. See, that's the essence of what emotional sobriety is about, is you don't lose yourself in the connection. So they can have their opinion of you, like you said, you know, their opinion is none of your business. But we don't have to cut them off because of the opinion. Before, if you didn't like me, I didn't want to have anything to do with you. Now,
right.
You don't have to like me. I can still talk to you. I can even learn maybe something about myself in terms of what it is that you're reacting to in me. And I might even be able to see something I can use. So there's this openness because I don't let... Most of the time, I don't let what the other person is thinking about me define me. What defines me is what I'm doing and how I'm thinking and how I'm behaving, not what they're doing.
You don't give them
and
any
that's
power.
Where things, yeah, that's right. That's a good shorthand way to say it, I think. And look, that takes a lot of work to do that, and I'm better able to do that at certain times than other times. You know, I still see this whole thing as a work in progress. But, boy, I'll tell you, the freedom you get in order to be able to be yourself and still stay connected in relationships, it's just amazing to me in terms of how this program works.
What I've learned is you might as well be yourself. Everybody else has been taken.
Oh, my God. Billy Crystal has just showed up to Rum Radio, ladies and gentlemen.
The... There was a lady on the Rowdy Rum, and I'm one of the they made me one of the admins. I'm on admins on a lot of the.
How did you get Rum Radio? Where did you come up with the title? Did anybody ask you that yet?
I have it on the website, but people, early on I had like one lady saying, I've had it many times, why rum? You know that's a trigger? And I says, lady, if that's a trigger, don't read the dictionary. It's only a word, you know, come on. It comes from, it's one of the stories in the third edition of the Big Book, Rum, Radio, and Rebellion.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, look at that, right? Connected up to the Big Book. How did he do that? When he pulled that, rabbit out of his ass?
He's doing that all the time. We got to watch this guy, Harold.
Yes.
I know that. I know you know that. That's why Harold's on the show to do interventions on you, Joseph. You don't know that, but that's why God put him here.
There we go. Yes.
So this one lady turns around, and she was an admin on the Rowdy Rum, and they sponsor me. They have a little thing, and they put a tags up, you know, originally that they agree with what I'm doing on the website. And the radio show is to get people to the website. You know, you're going to learn – if you listen to the radio shows, we have a lot of really pertinent, good information. Some of it's funny, but it's all program. And then get you to the website, and that's where all the definitive information is, where you can pay, cut, and copy and all that. So this one lady, when I first came in, you know, when the alcoholic mind and the drug addict, you know, it's this guy's trying to be somebody, you know, he hasn't really made much in his life, and now he's going to be a big shot in that. You know, you get he's promoting, you know, you get all that rigmarole. And she turned around to me and she said, I don't like you, you know, on the thing. So I wrote back to her, and I says, you know, I says, I like you, though, and you can't stop me.
Yes.
And after that, it's like it just put a pin in her. It deflated her, it diffused her, and now she's one of my biggest supporters.
Yeah, there you go. I know that how that works. That's right. That's great. Well, and see, you did that same thing that I was talking about, didn't you? So when I said emotional sobriety is, you know, staying connected to somebody and not just cutting them off because they don't like you and stuff, and you did that. You stayed connected with her and you held on to yourself. And that allowed, that created a new possibility in that relationship. So great example. So you didn't even know you were giving me such a great example.
I'm intuitive. I don't know why, but it just I guess I've been around long enough now.
Maybe
I have a lot of intuitive stuff.
That part of you is awakened, and that does awaken in us. I mean, that's the other thing I often tell people, that recovery is about discovering new possibilities. New possibilities in yourself, in life, in your relationships with others. I mean, it really is that portal into a whole new world. And that's the wonderful, exciting thing about this. So I hope if anybody is listening to this, is that they pick up that one thing, is that this has really awakened in me an incredible excitement about life and possibilities. And you know, a lot of people that have been in the field and working with people as long as I have, for 42 years, you know, they're pretty burned out by this by now. And, you know, I'm not. I just love every moment that I'm in my office with people. I love the trainings I do. I love the retreats I conduct. I am just so passionate about this way of life and helping people, you know, discover how to connect to the best in themselves rather than letting the worst in themselves run their lives.
So I go with this. I believe when we're in the service of our fellow beings, are we not in the service of our God? And when we're in that service and in that moment, is that not when we make our conscious contact with our Creator? Because now we're divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. I believe the magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. And I think that's the way you live the program.
Yeah, no, and you know what, it's interesting because I think a lot of people have made this a black and white issue, because when people hear me say add more self, well, wait a minute, we're told to get erase self, right, be selfless in the program. But and while that's true, it's not just it's not the whole picture. Yes, we need to be selfless, but there are also times when you also need to honor yourself in a relationship, when you need to respect yourself, and you need to be able to give yourself what you're hoping somebody else is going to give you. And so it's not that whole picture. So, you know, itself has gotten a bad rap in the 12-step program in a lot of ways. And I said that. That's another one of the stupid things, is I said confusing self-care with selfishness. See, that's another thing that's a big, big mistake. I need to learn to care about myself because I've never done that. I did not treat myself in a good way. I did not protect myself. I did not care for myself. And a big part of recovery is helping me learn to do that in a balanced and humble way, not out of being selfish, but out of being self-concerned. And there's a big difference.
Yes.
Now, you say that you were you're a gestalt psychologist and with an experiential. Give me a thumbnail on that, would you?
Well, I was very fortunate to have trained and spent over a couple decades with just a master therapist by the name of Walter Kempler. And Walter was very close with the fellow that founded gestalt therapy, Dr. Fritz Perls. And Dr. Kempler took the gestalt approach to individuals and applied that to working with couples and families. And I met Walt back in 1975, and for the next 20-plus years, I spent time either as the director of his institute in California or as one of the members of his training staff and going to Europe and teaching people how to work with families and couples in this very, very powerful way. So that was my entry into it. Essentially, the whole idea of gestalt therapy I found to be very complementary to what I was learning in my 12-step program, which is this. Gestalt therapy is not concerned with what you did in your past. It's concerned with what you're doing right now. Well, that spoke the world to me because I saw recovery was about what did I do now. It's not about what happened yesterday. It's like, what am I doing today? Am I taking right action today? Am I doing the things I need to do today to address my problem, to, you know, deal with my vulnerability to my addiction? So I love that. I found that to be incredibly, you know, complementary and in sync with what I was learning in program. The other principle of gestalt is that we believe it's what's right about people that causes problems, not what's wrong about them. It's the same idea that Dr. Carl Jung expressed to Bill Wilson when he said the alcoholic was in search of being one with something greater than himself, that the drinking was a spiritual thirst. So it was like what we say is that it's what's right about you that you're not honoring that caused you problems. And we don't honor them because of all these crazy things we learn in this culture about growing up and who we're supposed to be, who we think we should be. And so in gestalt, we don't live with any shoulds, right? It's about learning to trust your intuition, to listen to yourself, to be able to express yourself. And I found that's what I was learning in the program. It wasn't about what I should be doing. It was about what I was doing. And that was very, very helpful. So what I love about gestalt is that it's really helping people discover new possibilities. It's experientially based. We don't sit and talk about things. We actually get into action. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? I mean,
action and more action.
Action and more action. And that's what gestalt is about. So I'm very, very, you know, I feel very, very positive about it. And now I'm kind of developing what I'm calling process-focused experiential therapy, which is kind of dropping the gestalt name and capturing it in another way. And I'm just hoping to be able to share this way of working. You know, I'm getting a chance to do that now with a lot of different folks. And because I found it to be an incredibly powerful way of helping people find themselves and find a new way in their lives, whether they're in the program or not. So that's it in a nutshell. It just really spoke to me because I felt it was so organically based, you know, that it just... it related to everything I was learning in my own recovery, And I was seeing that when applied to working with people in a professional way, how powerful it was. So that's my version of Gestalt. You know,
okay,
it's kind of helping us. It's helping us become whole again. That's the other way I say it. See, I see the steps is helping us recover our lost true self. Gestalt therapy is doing the same thing. It's helping people recover the parts of them that they've disowned and fragmented themselves from.
Interesting. You know, you had mentioned that letter. The title of the letter, I believe, was Spiritus Contra Spiritum. Spirit against the ravages of spirits. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level for the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. Carl Jung.
Isn't that amazing?
A lot of folks don't realize that the key to really long-term sobriety, part of it is being in the moment. The Japanese call it satori. It's the most powerful place you can be. Matter of fact, the church today, it's interesting, one of the lessons we were having was about when you're living in the past, it's a spiritual block.
Yeah.
You're blocking the spirit when you're living in the past. So I would say then you're also blocking the spirit by living in the future, because the past is always about regret,
mm-hmm.
and the future is always about fear because you haven't been there yet. And you're everywhere but where you're supposed to be, and that's the most powerful place. That's where things really – that's where you live, because you can't go back. Hey,
right.
You haven't been forward yet.
Yeah, you got it. Right on. That's a great way to say it. And look, and we know that. I mean, look at the book, The Power of Now, that Eckhart Tolle wrote, and why it became so popular, because it's that same idea that it's right now that we discover, you know, what we need to do, our possibilities, and change our life. It's not about what's going to happen tomorrow, and it's sure not about what we did yesterday.
My father has a hard time with.
Oh, with
you.
That whole idea? Yeah. Well, of course he does. And I mean, you know, look, a lot of those folks came out of a depression where they had to think about their future because, you know, now wasn't much for them. And they had to hope that there was going to be something different. So I can totally understand that. And maybe some other generations, it won't be as relevant. But I don't know. For me, it's just a very, very powerful philosophy and a powerful way of trying to live to address the things I need to address in my life.
I wrote this stuff. The problem with the future is that it's always turning into the present. The problem with the present is always turning into the past. And the past has no problems. It only has regrets.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, that's good.
So well, tell us about the book.
Joseph, you got a book inside you, man. Look at that. You know,
you're not
much of a writer, but you seem to enjoy it. And it's time to stop thinking about yourself as not being a writer. You're quite a writer.
My 9-year-old granddaughter was sort of like the cherry on the cake. She turned around to me last week or two, and she says, "Papa, you got to write a book."
That's right. No, man, you've got some great stuff. Some great. I like the way you use language and express yourself.
Well, thank you.
Powerful.
Yeah, I do. I guess it's just that lazy. I put a lot of effort into the Rum Radio. I write to that. I've kept all my stuff, though. I have pages of sayings that I've created, and, you know, they're not all mine. T.S. Eliot said that immature poets try to copy – manipulate, and mature poets steal. So I steal from
them. I like that.
Yeah. And she told me, "Hey, Papa, you need to read." She's a sweetheart. We were at Johnson Space Center a year ago. She's gone 9 and a half. She was just turned 8. And she asked me questions all the time. And my stock answer is, "How do you know this, Pop?" I said, "Well, I have a library card." And that's my stock answer. She goes, "I know, you got a library." So she asked me something at the Johnson Space Center. Man, she's 8 years old. So, and I says, "I'm sorry, Claire, I don't know that." And she looked at me and she said, "What's the matter, honey? Lose your library card? Huh?"
Oh, very good. She's very sharp. Very
oh yeah, she's yeah. And I says, Claire, what's death to the ego? She said, that would be ridicule, Papa. Yeah, how many 8-year-olds can come up with that one?
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, let me share
anyway,
a little
so tell
bit,
us about
let me
about
just,
the books.
Let me tell you, let me just read a little piece from it. It's, you know, I was talking about the hidden rewards, and I was just kind of summarizing it. Let me just read you a paragraph from the 12 hidden rewards. It goes, with the weakening of the destructive forces of addiction and the false self, we have seen the constructive forces of our real self grow. We have recovered the ability to actualize our human potentials. The basic need we have for self-actualization is now flowing in our lives. It is encouraging and seeking our growth and maturation. It is driving us to reach our full human potential. It is motivating us to aim at doing our best and being our best. So that's what I see happen in the program, and I hope that somebody will look back at my life, especially my kids, and see that that's what's happened for me, is that this program has really inspired me to try to be the best person I can be and has also given me some tools. It's not just an idea, but some very practical ways of realizing that possibility in my life. And I'll be forever grateful for all that's been given me and for the life that I'm living today. And
that's
I really
great.
Appreciate you guys letting me come on the show and share it with you. Yeah, you know, people are interested in my books. You can just type in my name on Amazon, and they'll get pulled up, and you can take a look at them, and you can look at the, Amazon's got those great features of being able to go into the book and take a look at what the table of contents and some samples from the chapters. But the three books that are out from Hazleton are 12 Stupid Things, the one we talked about, 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery. Second one was 12 Smart Things to Do When the Booze and Drugs Are Gone, and that's all about emotional sobriety. And like I said, my new one's about the 12 Hidden Rewards of Making Amends. Before I wrote those three books, I wrote one book called Love Secrets Revealed, and that book contains all of the stuff that I learned from working with Dr. Kempler in terms of helping people put together strong and healthy relationships. So thanks for letting me share that with you guys.
You're welcome. Alan Berger.
Just type in Alan Berger on Amazon, or you type in 12 Stupid Things, and you'll be able to get to my books, or 12 Smart Things, or 12 Hidden Rewards. It'll take you right to the book on Amazon. You can learn more about my work by going to my website, which is www.abphd.com. That's abphd.com. That's Alpha, Bravo, Paul, Henry, David. Remember those call signs? Alpha, Bravo, Paul, Henry, David. Right? So www.abphd.com. You can learn more about my work, and you can even order some of my – I got a bunch of audio tapes and stuff like that. You can connect with my stuff. And look, this is what I tell everybody. If you're interested in some of my stuff and you can't afford it, you write me a letter and I send it to you. I mean, this is not like you said. I'm not out to make money. I'm out to share this stuff with people. You don't get wealthy.
No, this isn't a moneymaker.
This is not a moneymaker, man. If we wanted to be wealthy, this is not the field to go into.
You say that I had a guy the other day go, is this because I put the radio shows on, and one guy finally said, do you make money from this? And I wrote, yeah. Sorry, Chief, not a shekel, not a sou, not a dime.
Right.
But thank you,
Monty Myers has been doing this for a long time.
Oh,
you guys are of incredible service, and you guys do sacrifice and give a lot of yourselves. And I just want to take a moment to recognize what you've done, Joseph, and Harold, you as well, to give this time on a weekly basis. I know what that's like. Monty and I do a radio show called Step by Step Towards Emotional Sobriety, and it's really a labor of love.
When is that
show?
I'm
sure that's what it is. That show is usually on Fridays. We record it every other week, but the new show is always available Friday nights, and it's going through. We've got a great archive of a lot of great shows that we've done, but it's really talking about this whole issue of emotional sobriety that we've talked about.
That's
how
terrific. Take 12 Radio?
Yeah, Take 12 Radio with Monty Myers. He's
He's my co-host on the show, and I just love Monty and what he's doing. I'm sure you do too, Joseph.
And let me just mention to our listeners, I just went on Amazon and typed in 12 Stupid, and up came your book, and the Kindle edition's only $9.99, so I just pressed buy it, and so I've got it on my phone already.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and I want to get the other books. Mention again the emotional sobriety. What's the title of that one?
Right, that's 12 Smart Things to Do When the Booze and Drugs Are Gone, 12 Smart Things. The other one's 12 Hidden Rewards.
12 Hidden Rewards, 12 Smart Things, 12 Stupid Things.
And then 12 Hidden Rewards.
Cereal, yes.
Yeah, you guys get that. I like the number 12, don't you?
There you go.
I like 12. You know why? You ever wonder about 12? I mean, there's 12 months. 12 steps,
right,
12 apostles.
Steps. I like the 12
right,
steps.
12 days
I like
of Christmas.
12 things that you did, 12 days of Christmas. You're right.
You know why
12? 12 is a, no, why? Help me understand that.
12 is the number of the ultimate authority.
Ah, I like that. I like that. It feels so right.
Feels right, doesn't it?
Yeah, really.
12 months. Yeah. It's just what one thing I've learned through the 12 steps is that I could stop pretending to be someone else, and I can go back to pretending to be me. The
Right on.
Thanks again, Alan. That was great.
Yeah, thank you guys. This was great being on the show with you. Thanks for having me, Joseph. Harold, keep up the great work, and
we'll
meet face to face at some time.
I'm sure we will. Thanks again.
And, do one more thing. Let me give the correct spelling of Alan's name. It's Allen Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That'll help people find you on Amazon and on your website.
Right. Yeah,
yes.
There you go. Well, thanks, Harold. Thanks for that. And, Joseph, God bless you guys. And hopefully we'll do this again in the future and bring you guys in and join Monty and I on our show some night. We'll have you guys call in and be a part of our show on the emotional sobriety.
That'll be fun, yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that. I'll set it up with Monty. He'll be in touch with you.
Great.
All right, you guys.
Thanks.
Take care.
Mm-hmm. All right. On closing, I'd like to tell you that you have any last words, Harold, before I close?
No, this was a great program. I appreciate I hope our listeners got as much out of it as I did. So thanks for having me on, and thanks for having Alan Berger on.
You're welcome. In closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org, we're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. We're also on Facebook. It's under my name. Joseph Gansey. I'm a person in long-term recovery. We're not affiliated, so we try not to break the 11 tradition that way. There's no affiliation. We're just Rum Radio. I would have preferred to have just Rum Radio and not my name. Because of that, it would have been a little bit more productive, but it didn't quite work out that way. I'm not that astute technically in that. So we're pushing that out. It's sponsorship, one-on-one sponsorship. We believe that's the way it works. The big book is the template of all 12-step recovery. And we believe if you're working with the next follower, that's the next sufferer, that's an insurance policy you're taking out on your own recovery. So remember, if you're looking for sponsorship information, solid, funny, and spiritual, it's Rum Radio and rumradio.org. And remember, we'll see you on the radio. Good night.
Good night.